Humans are very social creatures who thrive in communities. Since time immemorial, we have used laws to help enforce the morals and mores of the day, especially those around sex and sexuality. Sex laws and the context in which they're written have the ability to foster an environment of either protection or discrimination in a community. From biblical law to Dickensian court reporting to Ireland's modern fight for equality and bodily autonomy, today on Our Sexual History, we'll be looking at the ways humanity has progressed and in some ways regressed when it comes to legalities around sex. Today on Our Sexual History, we have Rory Traynor, barrister and host of the Brief Notes podcast on Dublin City FM. Welcome, Rory.
Well, thank you very much for having me along, Shauna.
So what have you got for us today? You're going to talk to us about sexy sex laws?
Sexy sex laws.
And not so sexy sex laws?
Well, put it like this. If you're finding what I'm talking about sexy, you really have got to worry. This is not the area of law that most people find it comfortable talking about, because obviously when you're dealing with the law, you're dealing with people in unfortunate circumstances pretty much always. Nobody who ends up in court actually ever wants to be there. The law itself does, of course, throw up all sorts of fascinating and interesting tales that we can, with a greater or lesser degree of distance, with time and space, be able to look back and laugh. What happened yesterday is a tragedy. What happened a century ago is a farce.
Yeah.
So that's my view of the law.
Mm. So what kind of, like, just before we get into the podcasty stuff, so what kind of law do you specialize in?
Well, I'm a bit of a jack of all trades, master of none. I turn my hand to whatever comes my way. Now, most of my practice has involved criminal law. So a lot of that has been in down and dirty in the district court, plying my trade with all sorts of things, from driving offences to defending dogs. That was one of the more recent ones. And then I do have a slightly more exotic area of practice in the realms of data protection, and then I do a bit of child abuse work as well. So that's slightly more hard-edged work at a slightly higher level. So it just depends, to be honest. It depends what the person at the other end of the phone asks me to do. I'll do pretty much anything.
So now in your free time, you're supplying your sexy radio voice to different podcasts.
Well, yes, I have opinions, will travel. it's one of those challenges, like when I started off my own podcast, I might have trouble with getting content, because where am I going to find any lawyers with opinions that they want to share with other people?
All the lawyers.
So I've never really had a huge problem with, being able to get a guest, particularly last minute. There's always somebody who's willing to get their views out there into the big bad world. And also it's quite refreshing, because normally you find yourself constrained and only able to communicate ideas in an environment tied down to a courtroom or dealing with the client or whatever. But when you get into a podcasting environment or the radio environment, you can kind of relax a little bit. You can take the burden of your client or your responsibility to other people off your shoulders, and you can just say, right, well, here's what I think. Here's what's going on. And, it gives you a good bit of fun.
Yeah. So the reason I asked you on the podcast was,
is this about to be a surprise? The reason I asked you on the podcast
No. It was just, like, I like to give like a little bit of backstory to like why I have my guests on, like what their kind of specialty is. But like you and I were talking about like sex and sex laws. And one of the things that you talked to me about was about how back in the day, before we had like television and radio and like, sexy voiced podcasts like ours, that court reporting was very much seen as entertainment. So do you want to just tell us a little bit about that?
Well, court reporting still is. If for any listeners who watch Judge Judy, you'll know that court reporting can still be quite entertaining. I haven't watched Judge Rinder. Apparently he's even better. But there was a kind of 16th, 17th century equivalent. And indeed, even if you look at the career of Charles Dickens was a court reporter. And that's where he got the inspiration for a lot of his stories. stories. But court reporting was intended to sell the product. You wanted to get the words onto the page and get people to buy the pages. So you had to make it as entertaining as possible. Now, that meant, particularly in the 16th and 17th century, you would get these very ribald tales being told. And if any of you want to, any of the listeners want to go out and, you know, spend a bit of time instead of looking at, you know, here's some cute cats, go to a website called www.oldbaileyonline.org and you will burn days of your life there. I obviously have.
We'll put some links in the show notes for some of Rory's favorite cases.
You will find some fascinating stuff. But my favorite one of all of those was, and it tells you a lot about this story when it starts out with, the facts of this tale are too heinous to be repeated on these pages. And then it proceeds to hint at the facts of the story all the way through its telling. Now, what happened in this case was a woman was in her bedchamber, but the building was clearly not very well built. And there were holes in the wall. And one of her neighbours was walking by and saw through one of these holes in the wall.
Just happened to
glance through. And before her eyes, she saw her neighbour in something of a compromising position with a canine. And she was so shocked and appalled at what she saw that she immediately got her friend to come over and have a look too. And her friend went and got another friend. And eventually there was quite the gathering outside this woman's bedroom, gazing in through the numerous cracks in the wall at her activities. Their moral outrage eventually reaching such a height they could do nothing other than go and find the beadle, a local policeman or law enforcement official or whatever. And she was the woman.
How long was she boning this dog, or letting the dog bone her? This entire crowd, one person would grab another person, who would grab another person.
Well, we do know that there were quite a few people there, but we don't know quite how long it took for their moral outrage to demand that they something about it.
At least 20 minutes. So I had to watch it for a good, just to make sure that that was what was happening.
You know, you don't want to be caught in flagrante delicto. so it would be so embarrassing for everybody, the dog, etc. So they might have even politely waited until she finished, until they got the local constable to come and do what needed to be done. But either way, she was picked up and dragged off to the cells, and eventually her trial came round. And so, sure enough, this evidence was presented. You know, some good law-abiding citizen said, well, I saw her do this. And then another law-abiding citizen got up and said, I also saw her do this, and so on and so on. The woman protested with great vigour and said, look, none of this happened. These people clearly have a vendetta against me. Her husband, the husband of the woman in the bedchamber, was...
Not the husband of the dog.
Not the husband of the dog. As far as I can tell, the dog was male, from the hints that we gather. But this poor woman's husband then gets in the stand and says, these people are clearly doing it out of some vendetta.
Mm.
The judge, unconvinced either way, decides there's only one thing for it. We need some further evidence. And they called the dog. So the dog was brought in as witness. And the dog was led into the courtroom and was led up to the accused and proceeded to make friendly advances. And anybody who owns a dog or has had any experience of a dog which has not been fixed, as they say, will know exactly what I mean. And this being sure and certain evidence for the jury.
But also that's nervous dog behavior as well. It's not just horny dog behavior if they're in a big crowd that they're not used to.
I think, I don't know if they had an animal psychologist involved in the 17th century law courts. That probably wasn't well assessed. But either way, the dog had some degree of connection to this woman. They specified it was a mongrel, by the way, not a purebred dog.
Because that has any sort of standing.
Apparently it does. It's relevant in law reporting. And then lo and behold, the jury were then properly convinced that she was indeed a bestialist. She was duly convicted of her heinous crime with this dog. History does not recall what became of the dog thereafter. Possibly went for some counselling or whatever. But that's how law was reported back in the day.
And what was the woman's sentence?
Death.
Right.
Yeah. There were basically three types of sentence. There was flogging of some sort, there was deportation, or there was death. You know, you're not talking about people who have any great sums of money at their disposal at this time. Mm. So you get all sorts of tales like this in this marvelous resource. You'd be hard pushed to find anything as entertaining being reported in the law reports as we have them now, which are all very rarefied and scientific and proper sort of document. But
it's very similar to what I was talking to Sarah Griffin. I don't think you've met Sarah Griffin.
I have not.
She is a writer, and I had her on a couple episodes back where we were talking about witches and witch hunts and how to, like, you know, hunt witches and stuff. but like very, very similar, where you can point to anyone and say anything about a woman, just say she is of low moral standing, and off she goes to court.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's often said, you know, about the, you know, how terrible that the witch trials were and so on, but got rid of the witches. So I'm not pushed on it as a major moral issue, I haven't met a witch to my knowledge though, so maybe there's a bunch.
Well, apparently you're looking at one, because Sarah went through a checklist of things that would presumably make me a witch, and I scored pretty highly.
Wow.
On that.
I must try that out myself. I might discover I'm a witch.
I think you're definitely a witch.
I might have also teed myself up to be the victim of a witch hunt, quite literally being hunted by witches. Not that I've said such terrible things about witches to any witches out there listening. Honestly, I'm a nice person.
He loves witches. Some of his best friends are witches.
Absolutely. Look at my witch over here, as Donald Trump would say. No, I've got nothing against witches. I don't want to castigate anybody for regardless.
We'll put a hex on you.
You look like you're capable of it. Yeah. You're giving me those eyes. You can't see the evil eyes, listeners, but I'm getting the evil eye right now.
I've got the cauldron in the other room. I'm good to go.
I thought I could smell something funky going on in there. But yeah, in terms of that, you know, the righteous indignation of the law and so on, the great and shining example on the sexual front is a case, Orrin Brown. That was a UK case. What you had was a group of men engaged in sadomasochistic practices, some of which were recorded in the
course. What was the time period for this?
So we're talking 1980s into the 1990s. Okay. The trial kind of went on because it went to Europe and whatever. But what they were, this group of men were prosecuted for this, for the offence of grievous bodily harm, for what they were doing to each other. And their defence, understandably enough, was, well, we all consented. Now, their activities were at the upper end of the scale in terms of sadomasochistic activity. It was at the level of torture. But they were all consenting. So it didn't, so that, to their mind, shouldn't have been a problem. The House of Lords in the UK, now the UK Supreme Court, found against them on the basis that, well, really, you can't consent to a level of harm that is above a fixed level. So you can consent to somebody punching you in the face, that's not a problem. But you can't consent to somebody, say, paralysing you, because that's a really terrible thing. Well, can you consent to somebody temporarily paralysing you? Well, that might be a bit easier. So it's a bit of a grey area. But a view has to be taken in the interest of public order and morality and all of these sorts of nifty words judges get to deploy in the interest of their own moral compass, in order to secure the conviction of this group of men. Now, that case went to Europe, and it was they challenged it in the basis that they were having the right to a private life and a family life, and, you know, engage in whatever activities they wanted. They weren't harming anybody else, etc. And the European Court said, well, there has to be a line somewhere. We accept that there has to be a line, and where that line is affixed is a matter for the the nation's courts, it's not up to us to decide. So the UK court, in essence, was correct in its finding that this went too far. But to my mind, what makes this a really interesting case is if you consider something like body modification, tattoos, piercings, and so on, they are a much more common thing.
Yeah.
So somebody gets a tattoo and it is a permanent scar on a person's body.
And people do like scarification
and
as well.
There's also scarification and there's branding. There are all kinds of types of
permanent
modification, tongue splitting, all of that. You get that type of activity, but because it occurs in a context that's not sexual, it's perfectly acceptable.
Mm.
So if I were to say to somebody, branding is a good example. Would you make a nice, pretty, artistic brand on my arm so that I could have the symbol branded onto me? And, you know, that would be cool. And the courts would, in theory, say, well, that's fine because loads of people have branded. Well, not loads, but quite a few people have done it. It's a type of body modification. It's fine. However,
if I was
actually getting off on it, if it was providing some form of titillation for me, I'm not saying whether it would or it wouldn't, but if it did, you'd have a situation where it would be a criminal offence by the Orrin de Brown standard. So there's an element of hypocrisy that inevitably comes into play here, where some things are acceptable in some contexts and some things are unacceptable in other contexts.
And I think one really good example of this as well, and this is in the UK as well, you probably know about this, the ban that they have on certain types of porn being made in the UK, whereby anything to do with kind of bondage, S&M,
face-sitting, apparently.
Face-sitting and squirting. And the problem with that was a lot of that type of pornography was very much heavily showing depictions of female pleasure, of queer pleasure. So there was this fantastic protest a couple of years ago when these rules were being brought in, where they had a face sit-in and loads of protesters like just showed up in front of, I think it was like the ratings board or something, and they just had a face sit-in.
was it that chap Myers, the obscenity lawyer? He blogs as obscenity lawyer.
Miles Jackman.
you said potato. He's an absolute wonder in the legal sphere, and really carrying a torch of some great liberal lawyers, the likes of John Mortimer, and
he has a really great Twitter account as well, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well.
Everybody should be following Obscenity Lawyer. He's such an entertaining guy. But yeah, that kind of prim and proper peril clutching carry on that you get about sex and sexuality, particularly regarding types of sexuality that you don't find acceptable.
Mm.
Said the fact that Orrin Brown that was homosexual. If it was heterosexual, would it have been different? Well, it's a coin toss, but I would say there's a significant chance that it would be different.
Yeah,
there's still that's the morality of judges coming into play in a scenario involving people and their free choice to do what they want to do with their bodies.
It's really interesting because in the States, we have 50 states, and for the longest time, things like sodomy laws would have been dealt with state by state. So you have quite a lot of states, like in the Bible Belt, who still technically have sodomy laws on the books. But thanks to a Supreme Court case in 2003, Lawrence v. Texas, the Supreme Court decided that was unconstitutional to have sodomy laws because so often it came down against same-sex couples. Even though there were some states that like said like sodomy for anybody illegal, but like so many states had laws on the books, sodomy laws on the books that were just focused on same-sex couples. So now you have quite a number of states that still have these sodomy laws like technically on the books, but they're completely unenforceable because they've been deemed since 2003 to be unconstitutional. Yeah.
Well, the fact that that legislators, particularly in more conservative areas, would be afraid to be seen to decriminalize something, to remove something from the statute books, even though it is unconstitutional, is... indicative of cowardice on the part of the government. And it's not, this is not an American, a unique American phenomenon. Of course, I know we were probably going to talk about this later, so we'll inevitably get onto it now. That proud bugger in our midst, Senator David Norris, and his wonderful crusade regarding buggery. Now,
We're on it, let's just talk about it now.
The thing about what happened in Norris's case, now, he brought this challenge to Irish law.
This was in the 70s.
This is in the 70s, yeah. So what you had was, the Irish law was actually predating the Irish Constitution. So the Offences Against the Person Act 1961, and that created the offence of buggery. And then you had the Criminal Law Amendment Act 1885, which criminalised gross indecency, helpfully undefined. And his claim was that these were repugnant to the Constitution. Now,
was it true that a lot of these laws against homosexuality didn't include same-sex women? Like, it was more geared towards men.
It was very definitely geared towards men in terms of its conception. Now, did it absolutely exclude, did offences of gross indecency involving women, were they out? Were they impossible? No, you could still be prosecuted, but I haven't been able to find any example of it happening.
They just kept it vague enough to kind of include it.
Yeah, there was no. There's an apocryphal story about Victoria refusing to sign anything that would suggest that women would do anything with women. That's absolutely untrue. It's just utterly unthinkable about how a woman could sodomize another woman. But thanks to Pornhub, we all know exactly how that can be done. And thank God for the internet. But anyway, what you've got a few sort of elements to what David Norris was saying. Now, first of all, Article 50 of the Irish Constitution says that all laws before the Irish Constitution came into existence were good laws unless they were repugnant to the Constitution. Then there's the right to privacy, which doesn't actually exist in the Irish Constitution, save in the context of private family life. But the right to privacy does actually exist as an unenumerated right. Now, since the Constitution can't allow the state to freely read your correspondence or look at medical records, you do have some form of privacy guaranteed under the Constitution. So Norris claimed that his right to privacy was being infringed, this unenumerated right to privacy was being infringed by the state in criminalising an activity which he might choose to engage in, and so there was a conflict in the law between the old laws, the pre-constitution laws, and the 1937 constitution. So these laws should be deemed unconstitutional. Now, the Supreme Court weren't won over by the argument using, and the same arguments that are going to inevitably be deployed in the context of, say, a Louisiana law criminalising sodomy, the robust Christian nature of the state. And indeed, the Irish Constitution is a highly Christian document.
Didn't the bishops sort of supervise the writing of it?
Well, between the operations of John Charles McQuaid, the Archbishop of Dublin at the time of the writing of the Constitution, and also the impact of certain jurists of the time, most notably Gavin Duffy, who went on to be on the Supreme Court bench, they were extraordinarily conservative individuals, very Catholic, and were taking a lot of their inspiration in the authorship of the Constitution from constitutions, that Republican constitutions, say the Constitution in France and so on. But they were also determined to give it that that strong Christian foundation. A nice Catholic edge to it, which is still carried on to this day. Like, you only need to look at the Eighth Amendment and so on to see that is there defining our Constitution still, and it's inescapable that our Constitution is a Christian document, and it informs all discussion of that document, and so it leads to certain prejudices. Now, the upside for David Norris in his case was that he was that he was able to go off to the European Court of Human Rights because he has a right to a private and family life under the European Convention on Human Rights. Now, before that, there had been another case, and that case was taken by a Northern Irishman whose name escapes me right now, and he said, "I should be entitled to do whatever I want," and so that was in 1981. And
he brought that to the UK Supreme Court.
That went through the UK Supreme Court, and then ultimately ended up in Europe in 1981. And they held for him that he should be allowed to put his penis or have penises put in his bottom if he so wished.
Mm.
And there was no way, because there wasn't the requisite balancing act. Now, what Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights does.
So what's the requisite balancing act?
So the balancing act is an interesting thing. Now, Article 8 itself has these two parts. The first part is that everyone has the right to respect for their private and family life, their home and their correspondence. So that's the law set out flat. The second part of that is that any interference with that privacy must be in accordance with law. So that's part one. And then part two is it must be necessary for one of a specific set of purposes. The purposes being national security, public safety, the economic well-being of the country, to prevent crime and disorder, the protection of health and morals, and the protection of health or morals, and that's been a very important distinction in a couple of cases, and the protection of the rights and freedoms of others. So that's a balancing act that the states must engage in before they are able to violate your right to a private and family life and the privacy of your home and your correspondence. And the courts must carry out that weighing exercise, and failure to carry it out in an appropriate manner will render you fall foul of European law. And since this had already been decided, in essence, Norris was pushing an open door and successfully had those offences declared to be contrary to his human rights, which was all well and good. Apart from the incredibly long time that it then took them to actually set about repealing the laws and to bring the rights of homosexuals and homosexual couples into line with
because
those heterosexuals.
Even though like he brought it to the European Court of Human Rights and they favoured him in that, it took Ireland a really long time to actually...
In essence, it was simply an appeal. Simply a repeal. So I'm not entirely sure the exact date on which it was done. But it was, of course, a political hot potato. A lot of the people from more conservative constituencies, people who would have been more interested in having the blessing of the bishop than the blessing of the of the European Court of Human Rights would have been very much against it because they wouldn't want to lose the election or be told that they can't receive communion. Because if you can't receive communion, then you can't go to the funeral. If you can't go to the funeral, you can't shake all the hands to get the votes in order to get elected the next time around. That was how Irish politics was done, and to a certain extent might still be done today.
I think it's also important to point out the fact that David Norris's lawyer who took this case for him is our very own, like for Irish or non-Irish listeners, was Mary Robinson, our very first female president, and
an absolutely astounding woman. She went on to even greater things than being president. She went on to be.
She's going to save the world, Rory.
She is. She was the High Commissioner for Refugees in the United Nations, which is an amazing posting to get. And then she has also established the Mary Robinson Foundation, which does an awful lot of environmental work. So she's
out there fighting climate change, and
there is nothing this woman cannot do.
Mary, please come on my show. I love you.
She's so wonderful. If you got her on the show, I would be embarrassed to say I was ever on your show because she's such a wonderful, wonderful person. I don't deserve to be in her presence. Only at a very large distance, gazing lovingly.
I have friends that I go for coffee with every now and then, and without a doubt, every time we go for coffee, the the top of conversation always somehow spins to Mary Robinson. And just, isn't she just great?
What the non-Irish listeners probably won't know about either was The Tapestry. Shauna, I don't even, you probably never even saw The Tapestry in your time. There was on a shop window on Dame Street a beautiful rug, huge. It must have been like 2 meters by 3 meters or whatever. It was a massive piece of work, embroidered with the face of Mary Robinson.
Get me that rug.
It sat there gazing out lovingly at the people of Dame Street for a very long time. It's sadly gone because the shop itself is gone as well. I wonder what ever became of it. Anybody out there knows what happened to that rug? I'm sure somebody bought it.
it's bound to be in someone's home.
Maybe it's in David Norris's home.
How amazing would that be?
Although he wouldn't want to walk all over Mary Robinson, you'd have to.
Hang it up. Yeah.
She really did reform Ireland in spectacular ways. Mm. She made the Irish Presidency into a much more political office than it had been before. She was indicative, the first chink in the armor of the more of the conservative strand of Irish politics, because indeed it was supposed to be Brian Lennon Sr. who was meant to win that election. Everybody had said so, but sure enough, Mary inspired people in her informed and calm way that she has an ability to communicate so clearly that she was able to epitomise the direction which Ireland hoped to go. Of course, there were great plans for Brian Lennon Sr. to move into Oros Nuachtarán as the residence of the president, and that would be once he was elected. So they massively increased the presidential budget and they redid the house and everything, only for him to not win the election and for Mary Robinson to end up there instead, which upset quite a few people in the Fianna Fáil party ranks. They were most displeased that the electorate got it wrong. But she did wonderful. She was then able to do wonderful things with her huge budget and her beautiful new house.
Yes.
And more power to her for that. We need more like her. We do still have a few people out there flying the flag, but we will never have another Mary Robinson. She's unique.
Okay, so let's get back to sex laws now that we've had our Mary Robinson love in.
Yeah, I'm going to sound like I've got a bit of a thing for Mary Robinson, which we all do. So in relation to sex, like there's a question that keeps coming up, in sex and the law, and the question is always the same. What about consent?
Yeah.
Like, that's a big issue for everybody. Consent, still to this day, though possibly in a few days, this could be out of date, so watch this space. Consent doesn't have a definition. It's important to say that. It hasn't been defined. It might be in a few days, but it hasn't been defined yet. A common sense understanding has always been brought to consent. Now, it's obviously a thorny issue.
Do you think the reason, or because we don't have a definition of consent, that's possibly why we have so few convictions?
Well, no, I don't actually. The thing is about the common sense approach to an idea like consent is that, do you think this person consented to it or not? You don't. If you get bogged down in putting definitions to juries, and I'll just go on here to tell you about what the proposed law reform is. The proposed law reform introduces a definition of sex, which is definition of consent. A person consents to a sexual act if he or she freely and voluntarily agrees to engage in that act. Now, my question is, how much does the statement "he or she freely and voluntarily agrees to engage in that act" add to our understanding of consent? It's a definition. Okay, that's fine. Now we have to work out what the word "freely" means, what the word "voluntarily" means, what the word "agrees" is. These are also complicated terms. They're not straightforward. And, did she agree? What constitutes agreement? Does it have to be in writing? Can it be given verbally? Can it be given by a nod? Once you're into that question of communication, you get down into these really parsed, fine-grained questions when you should actually be looking at the big picture. The jury sat there, heard the evidence. They understand what the word consent means. They don't need it explained to them. They can just listen to what's being said and say, doesn't sound like she agreed to it. Or, yes, it sounds like he agreed to it. Or whatever, you know?
But I think so often, I just find it like so upsetting, like here in Ireland and back home in the States, I'm constantly bombarded with these stories of women who went through horrific traumas. And it just seems so obvious to everyone, like, yes, this person was indeed raped. And so there's like so few convictions, such a small percentage of like rape accusations actually go to trial, and then an incredibly small number of those end up in convictions because people think that women lie.
Well, what I would say about that is, just in the context of defining consent, first of all, adding more words to the law isn't actually going to change that. If you've now got a definition of consent, okay.
Like, are you saying like if you have a strict definition of consent that makes it easier for people to weasel out of it?
No. All that I'm saying is that it doesn't actually change anything.
Okay.
You define it, okay. But consent still has to be proven. We now have a definition of what consent is. That's fine. And you can put the question to the jury, does she consent to this? And by consent, we mean, did she freely and voluntarily agree to engage in this act? Now, I would suggest that most jurors, and indeed in the context of both a case being made for the prosecution and a case being made for the defence and the judge when they are giving their charge to the jury, would all up to now have used language much akin to that. That is pretty much what they said. What do we mean by consent? We mean, did she freely and voluntarily agree to engage in this act? That's the kind of language that would have been employed in the courtroom before the jury when they've heard the evidence anyway. So is it going to add very much? I don't think so. What I do think would make a palpable difference to the rate of to the rate of convictions would be an increased understanding of the nature of the process of the trial. Now, why would that make a difference? Why would the process result in more convictions? Well, there's a great mystery that surrounds the law. People see the wigs and the gowns, and they see the judge sitting up there looking very severe, and it's a very intimidating environment. It genuinely is for everybody going in. Nobody wants to be there. It's terrible.
And then you also have the victim having to face the perpetrator.
And then you've got the added aggravation of the, and I'm very strict about my language here. I don't talk about victims and perpetrators. I talk about complainants and accused. Now, the reason I do that is because I'm very old-fashioned. I'm old-fashioned in this respect. A person is a victim once a crime has been proven.
Okay.
A person is a complainant before the crime has been proven. They are the person making the complaint of the crime. A person is accused until they've been convicted. Once they are convicted, they are the criminal.
Okay.
You know, they are the perpetrator. In the courtroom environment, you've got, it's incredibly oppressive. It's very difficult, and certainly efforts are made to make it easier. But if there was a proper system whereby it was understood that the interests of the complainant were given equal weight to the interests of the prosecution and the interests of the defence, then we would have a very different environment in the courtroom. So, for example, if you have the prosecution, it's their job to be unbiased. It is their job to guide the jury through the evidence as the state believes it to be, and to present it fairly and accurately. It is the defence's job to then show that what of that evidence is good and reliable, or what isn't reliable. And then you have, then what you don't have, the gap that exists there, is on the complainant side. Now, I am not suggesting for one moment that there should be another person akin to the defence seeking, no matter what, that the person be convicted. doing basically the mirror image of the defense's job, which is very different to the prosecution's job, but rather what their job is to do is nothing to do with the outcome of the trial itself, but rather there specifically to protect the interests of the complainant.
Mm.
Now, that could be something as minor as being able to make an application to say, I believe that this questioning has gone too far, Judge. I think we need a break. Or I believe...
So like a counsellor or domestic violence.
Exactly. And if it was somebody of equal standing to the prosecution and the defence, mm. somebody there who had sat down and got to know this...
A third
legal team in there mm. who was there not to convince the jury of one thing or another, but just to make sure that in all of this procedure... And at any time, somebody could intervene if they were of a view that it was getting too much for this one complainant. And knowing that that person was there to do that particular job, and knowing that that person could then, if they felt under too much pressure, say, I'm sorry, Judge, I need a moment. And they can call over their representative and say, oh, could you, you know, tell me what, you know. Okay, what's going on here? You know, why am I doing this? And you can, you know, help them through the process. I'm not saying guide them in their evidence, but help them get through that experience and see them right the way through to the end, regardless of the outcome, because they're not there interested in the outcome. They're interested in the well-being of the complainant.
Mm.
Then you'd have a very different environment in the courtroom. There would also be somebody who'd be there to stand up and say, well, I'm sorry, no, I think that this, given my knowledge of my client, I can tell you that this line of questioning is likely to cause damage, and I'd ask that, you know, you tone down your questions or whatever, that sort of thing.
Do we have any examples of this worldwide? Are there any countries that are currently doing this, or states that are currently doing this?
It works in other systems. Now, nowhere's doing anything quite like that, but our system is different to what you see in most places, because we've got an adversarial system. It's a kind of them and us environment in which the complainant gets completely left out. So the state presents its case, the defence presents their case, and that's that. Everybody just, then the jury makes a decision, end off. Now, what you have in other countries is not an adversarial system, but an inquisitorial system, where the judge is tasked with learning about the case. They're not just there to parse the evidence. They're there to understand, to learn from the witnesses, to be guided through the law, to investigate it themselves, to ask their own questions, and to satisfy themselves of particular elements of the case, and potentially to say, okay, everybody, I want to know about this. I want you to go away and come back and tell me about the following. Now, that's what happens in other countries, which is a much easier environment to prosecute sexual offences, because there isn't a them and us environment. There are numerous parties with numerous different interests, and they're able to talk through it much more ably than the one side stands up, does their bit, other side stands up and does their bit, and the complainant is completely alienated. So that's what I would suggest as a kind of compromise, given that our system isn't going to change. We will still have the adversarial system, but we need something that's going to be more understandable, more relatable. In essence, a friendly face that is going to be there and can actually vindicate the rights of a complainant, and not the victim. The victim can have their day in court through civil action or whatever, but vindicate the rights of a complainant. Because I firmly believe that while people say, oh, what about victims' rights? Victims have rights once they're victims. Complainants don't have rights. And I think complainants should have rights. But I don't think that complainants should have I don't believe complainants have a vested interest in the outcome of the trial itself.
Mm.
I think that they have rights insofar as it is in the state's interest that offences be prosecuted, and if one of the costs of the state of an offence being prosecuted is that some person needs to be looked after a little bit better during that process, then the state should be doing that. And that should be part of the process. So that's my view.
Yeah, I completely agree. Okay, I wanna bring it back a little bit because we were talking about David Norris and taking his case and doing it on a right to privacy basis. So let's go back in our sexual laws time machine and let's talk a little bit about Roe v. Wade.
Oh yeah. Well, no, look, I'm not an American lawyer, so what.
Let's talk about it through an Irish lens. So you have Roe v. Wade, which guaranteed people the right to privacy when it comes to sexual health.
Reproductive rights.
Rights. Let's just put it plainly, abortion. Mm. And then soon after that, now that was in the States. And then just a little while after that, we have the Eighth Amendment here in Ireland. So for our non-Irish listeners, I'm sure our Irish listeners are probably sick and tired of hearing about the Eighth Amendment. But just for our non-Irish listeners, can you please give us a very brief explanation of what the Eighth Amendment was?
So the Eighth Amendment
is
the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution was an amendment introduced for the purposes of answering a very simple question, really, is can you have an abortion in Ireland, and if so, on what basis? Now, there was a black hole in the law in Ireland where abortion was concerned. There was certainly a right to life, then there was the rights of the mother, and so on. All of this kind of mess. What the Eighth Amendment did was it put to the people a solution to this problem, supposedly. And the Eighth Amendment places on an equal footing the right to life of the mother and the unborn child. The state shall give adequate weight to the right to life of the equal value to the right to life of the unborn and the mother. Now, that, of course, didn't mention the word abortion. And when you don't grasp the nettle fully, you are in trouble. Mm-hmm. Because now we end up in a situation where a balancing act happens.
It's incredibly vague. It's incredibly vague. It's one line.
So, yeah. So you've got this absolute unknown entity of, you know, what is this equal weighting? What is, you know, what do you mean by the unborn exactly? You know, are we talking about the frozen fetus? Are we talking about, you know, where do we go with this? And so you end up with all of these other cases that follow on, including the most famous ones, the cases relating to suicide. And there were several of these, actually, in the, where what happens if somebody is about to kill themselves because they're pregnant and carrying out a termination will save their life? Well, it was argued by, amongst others, Professor William Benchy prior to that referendum that that would not be a consequence. And to get back to Mary Robinson, she said, well, if somebody's going to kill themselves because they're pregnant, then this does come into it because this violates the right to life. Mm. Because this is the mother's right to life here that we're talking about. Professor Benchy said no. Mary Robinson said yes.
She actually predicted a few cases.
Yeah, oh, she did. Yeah.
Just like potential cases, and then they ended up being true.
What about travel was another one that she... Yeah. And then she said, well, and then there was the question of abortion information, which was another issue. So there were...
Which we won in, was it 94 or something?
Yeah.
The right to information.
The right to abortion information, that was, well, there were a string of cases. There was Buck v. Grogan, and as I think that eventually, it was 94, I think. Well, my memory's failing me now. I'm not good on dates. So what happened there was you had, you know, could people learn about abortion? You ended up having to have another referendum about whether people could gain abortion information, which was all completely circumvented by somebody announcing the names of all these abortion clinics in the UK that they could, and giving out their names and phone numbers, but doing it under dual privilege, so they were immune. So that solved that issue in a very Irish way. Now, we then have this litany of cases that start to crop up, all because of this Eighth Amendment. Right enough, they were all predictable at the time. And then you get the more recent ones, the case of Savita Halappanavar. That was particularly tragic. But then there have been other cases. Miss Y was another. There was a case of a woman who arrived severely mentally disturbed, had been from all apparent evidence, she'd been the victim of rape. She requested an abortion. She was refused because she was under the care of the state. She was forced to carry the child to term. She had the child, devastating consequences. All of which, due to the prevarication of the government and the actions in the courts, could have been dealt with far, far easier by just carrying out the termination, because she was clearly incapable of surviving, psychologically surviving the process that she was put through. So instead, they carried out a cesarean section as soon as it was viable to do so. So they'd rather she carry the child and then rip it out of her womb than take the risk of, you know, carrying out a very early term abortion.
Yeah.
And putting her through that was the decision. And that's utterly horrific. On a human level, the idea that you would do that you put a woman through that who's already been through so much. But anyway, so we then have this Eighth Amendment, which is still with us to this day, and which, despite the introduction of the Protection of Life During Pregnancy Bill, which, never forget, criminalizes a woman having an abortion and criminalizes somebody assisting having an abortion. What exactly constitutes assisting having an abortion is unknown, but assisting somebody, so you holding her hand and taking her to the airport, for example, would be...
Could the airport technically be liable?
Well, this was the question. How many times should Ryanair be prosecuted for assisting an abortion? That's the big question. Yeah. How many times should Irish Ferries be prosecuted for assisting an abortion? There's the breadth of this law. Slightly absurd argument. But would be paying for your friend's flight, would that constitute assisting an abortion? I think it would.
Mm.
Lending them your credit card because they don't have the ready cash? I think that would constitute assisting an abortion. So you can't really see where any of this ends. The only way to actually end any of this stuff, and I've got a very radical view on the Irish Constitution, the only way you can solve this and many other problems is get rid of it. I have no faith in the Irish Constitution as it is, as it stands as a legal document. It has only stood the test of time.
That's a very controversial opinion to have with an accent like yours.
Well, I know. As those who are not from these islands will not be aware, I am from Northern Ireland. I just to prove it, I can tell you I'm from Northern Ireland, if that makes you feel any more comfortable. Sound a bit more like I'm in the name of the Father now.
Coming over here making fun of our constitution. Though I'm like, I'm one to talk with my American accent.
At least you have a Supreme Court that decides things like Roe v. Wade. I'm very jealous. No, what we have is an old-fashioned document that's no longer fit for purpose. You've got concepts like the woman's place in the home and the Eighth Amendment, and you've got this really absurd outrage of a balancing act. We talk about these balancing acts, but the idea that that people shall have their right to liberty and free expression and so on protected within public order and morality,
yeah,
which is particularly intimidating. The European view on this is quite different. A case called Handyside, which does not require that balancing act, but rather a wonderful term. You enjoy the right to offend, shock, and disturb. I love those words. So you can offend, shock, and disturb wherever you like in Europe, as long as you don't do it in Ireland. That's why Alan Shatter's book was banned.
I actually have a copy of that.
Oh,
yeah, dirty. Laura. Yeah.
Oh wow, I've never gotten around to reading it.
Oh my gosh. So the week that I got my citizenship, Alan Shatter was our justice minister, so he was sort of the MC, as if you will, for the event, for like he was the MC for the citizenship ceremony. So that week, when he I got my citizenship, it came out in the news that he had this like romance novel that he had written back in like 1989. And actually, I was just like, oh my God, and that's the guy. I have to go get that book. And it's so funny because, like, as you probably know, Alan Shatter is a family law person.
He quite literally wrote the book on family law.
Literally. And Laura reads like a family law novel almost. Like it's incredibly, like, I've never seen more boring sex scenes than in this book, because it's written like a law document.
As you might suggest, it's more of a two-hand read than a one-hand read. Is that what you're telling us?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
Well, I'm not going to judge a book that I haven't written.
Alan, stick to your day job.
He's back being a solicitor, since he's no longer our Minister for Justice or indeed a TD anymore. But what I do know of that book is that he was in some ways prescient in dealing with the abortion issue in that book.
Yeah.
So he was perfectly willing to tackle those questions.
Yeah.
I just wanted to use this opportunity, now that you've got me here and I get in the airways, because normally I'm on the other side of the microphone. I just wanted to say something about the consent concept.
Okay.
I know we've covered that quite well, but I think that the concept of consent is an unnecessarily sticky one. I don't think that that is where the law should be pushing itself towards. You know, it's like, did a person consent? The circumstances under which they could or could not consent. All of the stuff that's coming up, that's been introduced in a reform to the Criminal Law Sexual Offences Bill 2015, which is now, which should be ratified in the next short while. But I disagree with the approach. I actually think that the relevant question, and this comes to a question not just of rape victims and not just a question of people operating under circumstances of duress, but actually more broadly in people suffering from mental disability and some inability to perform these functions, to function ordinarily, as we might put it, somewhat crassly. Maybe what we should be looking at is to see the circumstances of the event and to work out from the circumstances, are they exploitative? Because the act of rape and the act of sexual abuse, they are exploitative by nature. And surely the question is not whether the person consented or not, or whether the person had capacity to consent or not, but whether the sexual intercourse or whatever sexual act it was occurred under circumstances of exploitation.
Mm.
And that, while obviously I can see the other side coming at that, which involves a huge question about.
So there's also tricky situations with regards to things like ability, whether if it's a physical disability or a mental disability, whether or not those people can consent, because oftentimes we infantilize people or asexualize people that we shouldn't be asexualizing.
Yeah. And one of the shocking things about it is that in Ireland, we kind of have an on-off switch.
Mm.
This idea that you, this is changing a little, but on the one hand, you have a person who has capacity, and on the other hand, you have a person who doesn't have capacity, and you're either one or the other. You can't be anywhere in between. There's no such thing as assisted. Well, there is no assisted decision making in the context of making wills or engaging in financial contracts. Assisted decision making, it's becoming an important thing, but it doesn't exist in the sexual context. Doesn't exist in the marital context. People just can't do it, and it's that. Hard line that exists that I think is likely to cause great hurt to people under suffering from a mental disability. They are deprived of leading full lives because it's apparently beyond the ingenuity of mankind to come up with a way of making sure that they can have a relationship and be safe. That's absurd. What we can do is we can make sure that the person isn't being exploited. And if we protect a person from exploitation, then they have every right to engage in the fullness of life, and that includes sexual activities.
Mm.
So that's my view on that. And it takes away the question of consent if you can just prove that somebody did something under circumstance that was exploitative, then that is sufficient as a sexual offence. And that people get latched onto the word rape, people get latched onto words like consent. But I think anybody engaging in sex in an exploitative manner is as guilty of an offence as anybody else. And we see that in child pornography cases. That's exploitative. They might have no connection to the victim of the child pornography, but they do. But it is exploitative.
Mm.
So that should surely be our focus, and that's the way I would like to see the law going, rather than getting bogged down in questions of rape and consent and so on.
Yeah,
slightly controversial. I'm not going to lie.
Well, I think for me it's sort of a, like you said, it's a language thing, and I wouldn't want to while I completely agree with you that like we should be looking at it, whether or not it should be exploitative, I'm worried that we're kind of, if we use just the word exploitative, does it then take away from instances where violence has occurred?
Exploitative circumstances can occur in all sorts of ways. You can have emotionally exploitative scenarios. For example, when there used to be the old rule of a conjugal duty of a wife to provide the necessary orifices for the enjoyment of her husband. Well, the that gave rise to exploitative relationships, and you can have psychologically exploitative, emotionally exploitative, as well as physically exploitative relationships. You can have relationships of dependence and power play that are of such a kind that a person could be said to be deprived of their free will. Now, that might sound in some way paternalistic, but I'd rather have a paternalism that gives rise to a greater level of successful and effective prosecutions of what things that ought to be crimes, rather than failing to prosecute things that actually are crimes already. But that's, as I say, slightly controversial view. Now, the question is very gender fraught, though, and you get ideas like, you know, about women engaging in sex are never prosecuted for rape, but men engaging in sex are prosecuted for rape.
And that's another thing I wanted to talk to you about is this idea that, and I think it makes it particularly difficult. I'm going to use your language here for complainants, because oftentimes when we think of cases of rape or sexual exploitation, we're thinking of women, and there. I think it's very difficult for, like, it's incredibly difficult for women to come forward with their cases, but also probably almost even more so for men, because there's this idea that men can't be raped, or in the cases of trans people, like, those groups of people just would oftentimes feel that there will be no justice for them, equally, if not more so, than women.
Well, I think that's most definitely the case. It's one of those things, though, that people can't expect the world from the law. You go to court seeking law, not justice, is one of the old sayings. When it comes to matters like these, where you're talking about law enforcement, or when you're talking about what rights are being better vindicated, or who's being better protected, these are actually societal jobs to make sure that the people, that any person who suffers as a victim of an offence, or any person making a complaint to the Gardaí, that an offence has been committed against them, should not in any way, on the basis of any ground of discrimination, feel intimidated or wary of the activities of the reaction of the state agency charged with that role. But that's all about communication. And the Gardaí, and I don't often have very nice things to say about the Gardaí, but in this one respect, I will say they have done brilliantly. They have got very adaptable, very well-trained units that do listen to what people have said. Their job is to deal with these specialist cases, the unusual, the sex worker who's raped during the context of their work, the trans person who's raped. They have specialists who work in these scenarios. Now, do they have enough specialists? No, they don't. Will they ever be able to address every case adequately? No, they won't. We should expect them to, but they won't. That's the nature of humanity, I'm afraid. But there is an awakening happening. And I think that the world is becoming more aware. Certainly, Ireland is becoming more aware of the diversity of people, the diversity of interests, the diversity of needs of the members of society. And with that gradual awareness is becoming a responsiveness of the state agencies, particularly the Gardaí, but also the court service and counselling services and education as well. You know, they're becoming more responsive to these needs, these increasingly niche, unusual, difficult, complicated, but very important needs that people, that individuals experience. Mm. And I think that we are actually going the right direction. It's just never going to be there fast enough. And that's sad, but it just requires an alertness, a responsiveness, an awareness on the part of the state in order to do it properly.
Mm. I think the last thing I want to ask you is, are there any laws going forward that will be enacted or have currently been enacted that you see as being very positive and hopeful to protect people sexually?
Well, sexually, there's obviously the recent amendment to Section 9 of the Criminal Justice Sexual Offences Bill. So that was just introduced in the last 2 weeks, which not just... Not
but only, it is not, quite controversial bill.
It's only I'm saying it's controversial, to be honest. I'm just the sort of curmudgeon from the side going, oh, I'm not so sure. What's interesting about it is that... that aspect of it, yes, it is a very controversial bill. It's just this one section that I'm fixating on that nobody else seems to think is controversial than I do. one of the things that it does do is that it actually sets out a list of circumstances which will be considered to give rise to a lack of consent. So it does say if you are a certain level of intoxication, if you are unresponsive, if you are whatever, it sets out those very clear, black and white, and lawyers can say, this is that situation, therefore this is a crime. And that is a very positive step, but it also leaves open the possibility of the being ones that aren't in the list. Yeah. which is a very welcome bit of subtlety. So that's one good thing that has been introduced, or that will become law. Obviously, there are laws in relation to prostitution, which I can't say I'm an authority on the issue of prostitution, so I don't know. But I think that they are potentially a backward step. I think that the more you criminalize something, the more dangerous you make it. That's been proven with drugs. It's been proven with guns. The point is to legalize and regulate. Obviously, we don't want guns in everybody's pockets, but you can have a gun in Ireland. You just need to tick a lot of boxes to get one.
I have so much that I want to say about the sex work aspect of it.
I gotta hold my hands up and say I'm not an expert.
We're totally out of time. Mm. So I'll have to get another guest expert in to talk about that, because it is something that I really want to cover on this podcast. But sadly, we are out of time. Oh. So I want to thank Rory for coming in and talking to us about sex laws. I feel like I should have you in again, because there's just so much that we wanted to cover, and you came in with such a wealth of like case studies that we didn't get to cover.
I didn't want to turn it into a law lecture though, because that would get really boring.
I'm not going to lie, you kind of already did, but that's totally okay. So Rory, thank you so much for coming in, and we will have you back in again, I'm sure.
It was my absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on, Shauna.
Thanks so much to Rory Trainer for coming in and giving us that law lesson. And a special thanks to Mary Robinson just for being Mary Robinson and nothing short of a superhero. Our Sexual History is produced by Alan Bennett, with music by Shane O'Sullivan and artwork by Sheena Flynn. We're recording this on Valentine's Day, so if you love Our Sexual History and all our other podcasts in the Headstuff family, please consider sending us a Valentine in the form of subscribing, rating, and commenting. And if you're feeling especially amorous, you can donate to our Patreon to help Headstuff pay us and continue to publish quality, thought-provoking articles and podcasts. One that you might like to give a listen to is our brand new show, Personality Bingo with Tom Morin. 60 balls, 60 minutes, 60 questions. In those 60 minutes, Tom rolls his 13-euro Argus-bought bingo ball machine and asks his guest the corresponding question to that number ball. At the beginning of the show, the guest receives six numbers, and if their six balls are drawn, they get to pick a question to ask Tom, and he has to give a totally honest answer. The first episode is out now with guest Davey Riley, and I cannot wait to listen to this when I'm done recording here. That's it for now. We'll catch you again next month.
This podcast is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network.